Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, this is Rebecca Buchanan, host of New Books Network, New Books and Literature. And today I'm here with Rachel Greenlaw, the author of Compass and Blade. Rachel, thanks for being here with me today.
Hi, thank you so much for inviting me.
So could you just start by giving sort of the premise of your book, telling us about what your book's about?
Yes, so Compass and Blade is the first book in a young adult epic fantasy romance adventure series, and it tells the story of a young woman called Mira who lives on a remote island, and her community survived by wrecking passing ships and plundering them. One day her father is taken by the Watch, and in order to rescue him she goes on a journey far from her island home and known world, travels deep across the ocean to find something to rescue him with, and along the way she learns something very shocking about herself.
So could you start by talking a little bit about how this book came to be, why you decided to sort of start this series and write this this sort of epic adventure?
Well, I've always loved young adult, and actually it's what got me writing again after sort of quite a few years away after university. And I live on quite a remote island off the coast of the UK, the south coast of the UK, and I go sea swimming quite a bit. And it's an interesting place. It's surrounded by shipwrecks. There's over 1,000 wrecks surrounding the islands where I live. And I was out sea swimming, and I suddenly had this image of a girl swimming out in a very stormy, on a very stormy night, and she was swimming towards a ship that was wrecked on her shores. And I couldn't shake that image of this young woman. And I started writing that scene out in my head. And what you'll find in the first chapter is pretty much what I wrote after that sea swim. And it just went from there.
So you've got this, you were saying, you sort of live in this sort of remote place in this remote island. So can you talk a little bit about the kind of the world that you have built around this island and sort of where Miriam lives and that kind of thing? Can you talk a little bit about that world and that space?
Yeah, of course. So what I drew as inspiration from where I live is like more kind of details, sensory details, historic details. So for example, the whole premise of Mira and the seven of them that swim out on a rope to the ships to plunder and see who they can save. It's actually based on something more factual. So about 150 years ago, each island had a pilot gig boat, which is a six-seater gig boat, and in storms or just normal days there would be ships sailing past, and because the islands are so surrounded by rocks, hidden rocks that aren't always charted on nautical maps, they would need someone to help them navigate through. So every island would have a gig, and the kind of, if when one of them was sighted, they would all pile into the gigs as fast as they could with a pilot, someone who knows how to navigate through these rocks, and they, whoever got to the ship first would get the job, and they get paid. And then they would help that ship navigate through the rocks, and sometimes they also went out in very harsh, terrible conditions, awful storms, to save people. And then if there was anything washed up on the shore, or if there was any cargo left, they would claim salvage and they would keep it. So that's kind of where the premise of the story came from. But I also drew on kind of the myths and legends surrounding the islands, and also surrounding Cornwall, very much like Celtic myths and legends about like sirens and sea serpents, and the kind of creatures that you'll find in the ocean. And I wanted to weave those through this story to kind of bring out the magical side that I experience of island life, which really feels like if you just turn a corner, you could find a siren swimming in the water, like anything is possible. So that's kind of where my inspiration came from for the series. But it also draws on my like deep love of fantasy books. And as we go through the rest of the series, you start on this kind of postage stamp of Mira's known world of the Fortunate Isles. And then if you look at the map in the book, which is at the front of every edition, you kind of expand out and see more of the rest of the world, the people, the witches, the rulers, the politics, and kind of get a wider lens of what's really going on in this like vast, sprawling fantasy world.
So yeah, you brought up some of the things I wanted to ask you about because like Mira's Island does not seem to have magic on it, right? Like there seems to be like as she goes sort of on her adventure, we'll call it an adventure, right? Or her quest, she starts to see or learn more about sort of magic and how magic plays a role in sort of these mythic creatures. And so, can you talk a little more about that, and sort of the mythic magic that sort of exists in this world?
Yeah, of course. So I'm not sure if I don't think it's a spoiler. But the basic premise of the idea of the magic system of this world is that magic exists in the wilds of the world. Like her mother in her stories when she was younger called it the wild corners of the world. And what she meant is, and what Mira discovers is that magic is found in the blood of creatures and monsters. And then it is used by the witches and the apothecaries to create spells, poisons, potions, and tinctures for normal human beings to use. So I really wanted to create a magic system that was unique, but also drew on what I think could exist. It could be possible that there are creatures and monsters. And what would humans do if we discovered that they had properties that we could use? And I don't think we would be particularly kind. I think that we would exploit them for our own gains. So this is a whole world that's built a kind of commerce around exploiting what these creatures have in their blood. So we will meet witches in book two, and I really wanted to create this entire world of morally grey characters so that readers could explore the world and decide for themselves where they draw the line and what they think is acceptable and what is completely inhumane. And I wanted it to spark some controversy and some conversations, and I think it does.
Yeah, I was going to say, one of the things that I really liked was that I felt that this could be a world that we are in, right? Like it wasn't that it was like this. You couldn't sort of figure out the, in a good way, I mean this, like the time period, right? It didn't read like this was a long time ago where people were not, did not know about medicine, did not know about sort of magic, and it didn't seem like it was in the, didn't necessarily need to be in the like long distant future either. Like it was very much situated in a time where it could be happening right now, right? Or it could ha like in a if in a different universe at this very time, this could be the thing. So I appreciated how that played out and how that I could see this being part of our world, right?
Yeah, I really love the idea of kind of universes nudging up against each other, like if you just step through a doorway in our world, you could land in a world that is just a few steps away from ours. And maybe that's a spoiler, but I find that idea really interesting. And actually, if you look at the map in the front of the books, there is a reason why it looks almost like a map of Europe. And I wanted to explore that idea of, if our world had magic, and maybe it was about the year 1800, what would that look like? So when you read through the book, there will be details in there which kind of help you place it in an historical time period. And I was drawing on the kind of feel of Poldark. And if you start reading those books and watching that series, it's kind of that period that's just at the end of the 1700s, nudging into the 1800s. So I've tried to like research and find like exact historical details that would pinpoint somebody in that time period. And I really enjoy that kind of research, and I find it completely fascinating. So that's kind of the kind of very broad strokes historical time period that these books are set in, and that this world is set in. And that is intentional because I wanted to set it just before the Industrial Revolution, because I do think it'd be interesting to take a look at a world where there was a magical revolution. So we're looking at a world that's kind of on the cusp of change, and we're seeing it through Mira's eyes as she experiences it and as she goes through it. And I think that that's going to be a really fun thing to explore over the next two books.
I love the idea of having a magical revolution instead of an industrial revolution, and kind of think that that might have made our world better in many ways. Yes, and I do love that there are pirates, right? There's
Yeah,
these
essentially.
important, yeah. Can you, so you talk, one of the things you said earlier was that you have these kind of morally gray characters. And that's another thing that I really enjoyed as I was reading was that I didn't know who to trust, right? Like in a good way, like, sometimes you're like, okay, this is the good, this is the bad. But there's some ambiguity throughout this, and you get to kind of see different points of views and different motivations. So, can you talk a little bit about some of those other characters who we see in this who will probably continue to exist as we move through your other books in this series?
Yeah, of course. So let's talk about Mira first. So Mira, she's extremely loyal to her community, to the people that she's grown up with and fought alongside. And she will do anything for them. She will break the law, and she believes what she's doing is right. She believes that when she looks around at her community and she sees hungry people who are scratching a living, that when they wreck a ship and plunder it, she's doing the right thing, because she's helping them survive. Obviously, there's a very there's a moral argument against that. But Mira's still, she's a teenager and she's still learning, and she's getting a better look at the wider world now. So she'll start to make up her own mind about things now she's moving away from her community and her island life. A couple of other characters that you'll meet in book one that will appear in future books are Eli and Seth. These two guys that she meets, and they're quite truthful in the way that they don't pretend to be anything but selfish and kind of out for their own reasons. And so she kind of has to learn who to trust and what to believe, and she has to learn that some people are out for themselves and they're not out to help others. And she has to decide who she's going to align her interests with. So I do find it quite interesting writing morally grey characters, because I think that even the best people among us, they've always got a little bit of bad in them. And I find it really interesting to explore that in characters. And I think that makes them human and
So,
relatable.
yeah, and that was the thing, like, 'cause I'm like, do you wanna, like, okay, do we go along? Do we trust this person? Do we not? And another thing, that I really enjoyed was that we got to, so we not only sort of saw Muir's Island, but we got to see a couple different islands and see how they, I don't know if work together is the right word, but could you talk a little bit about some of the major, because I feel like the islands and the sea are as much part of the story and characters in the story, right? So can you talk a little bit about sort of the different islands and maybe the watch and who they are in this story?
Yeah, of course. So Mira goes to one of the islands she goes to is Penscallo, which is one of the islands within the Fortunate Isles, where her island Rosevere is. It's like an archipelago. And Penscallo is a lot more, it's where they go to the market each week to sell goods. The island is like a lot more prosperous, mainly because it's been adopted as the stronghold of the Watch. The Watch are the kind of law enforcers of the ruling council of where she lives, and they've brought money in into the islands, but they also want to stamp out any wrongdoing, like wrecking. They don't agree with what Mira and the other islanders are doing, so it's very interesting to see Penscallo from Mira's perspective when she goes and visits, and she sees the watch and she speaks to them and she listens to what they think, because obviously they're on a completely opposite side to her. So you've got to decide whether they're the villains or not. I personally think they're the villains, but readers may choose to believe otherwise. Another place that Mira visits is Port Tren in Book One, and that is actually on the mainland of Arnhem, which is part of like what Fortunate Isles is part of, that country. And she first visits an apothecary, which is a place where any normal person can buy some kind of tincture or lotion which has a little bit of magic in it. So that's where you go, like if you need to be healed in some way, like if you've got a cut, graze, if you're poorly, you can go and buy something from there that's got magic in it. She also sees wanted posters. She sees other men of the watch. So she gets kind of an idea of why the watch are on their islands, what they're doing there, and how important they are. To the country where she lives. They're there to uphold the law and they take bribes. They're not necessarily all good people, but they are a lot stronger than her and the other islanders, and they're there to take over.
So one of the things that you talked a little bit about sort of how you sort of the premise or how you got, started writing this. So I would love for you to talk a little bit about in your process. Like you said, this is a going to be a three-part series. Did you start with that in mind? Can you talk a little bit about the process of thinking of a trilogy, writing a trilogy, or did you start by thinking, I'm just going to write this book and then see how it came to be a trilogy?
Sure. So I've never written a trilogy before. This is my first trilogy, and but I love reading them, and I wanted to create something that wasn't just a standalone, and I didn't think that Mira's story could fit in a duology. I thought it would be longer than that. So a trilogy felt like a good series length. For a kind of really epic fantasy story and for all of those arcs to play out. So after I drafted the first book, I wrote a series plan for book two and book three, and that was before we even took it on submission. So I always knew the sort of end game before the first book was even published. But I will say though that I'm editing book two at the moment, so it's written and I'm editing it, and there are still surprises and things that I hadn't envisaged in that original series plan, that I'm weaving into books two and book three, which I think elevate it and only really have appeared because I've spent more time with these characters and in this world, and I've thought a lot more about what they would do and how they would react and how things would really play out in this world when Mira is trying to take back her home. So it's in part it's it was planned, and in part it's an exploration, and it's a lot of fun. It's a challenge for sure. It's a big challenge, but I'm enjoying it.
So do you think that by the time you get to book three, what you originally thought was going to happen at the original ending is still going to be that ending? Or do you think are you still in a gray area that things might, change enough from your original? Or are you kind of like, I think that this is where Mira's going and what's going to happen?
Oh, the ending is still going to be the same ending that I envisaged was drafting book one. Like it will still all end the same way. But the journey to get there's been some interesting twists that I wasn't anticipating, and another character joining who I didn't see to begin with, but actually makes perfect sense. And I hope that when book three releases, I'll be able to start talking about some of these things in more sort of obvious terms and not be hiding so many secrets.
No, that makes sense. When you wrote this, was it very much like is it very much like you're driven by the characters? Are you driven by like this world, this plot? Like what is like is it Mira that's sort of guiding you through this? Like could you talk a little bit about that? Who's sort of who's your compass?
I love that. For me, it was the world first. I had this idea for this fantasy world years ago, but it was only when I saw Mira and specifically the Fortunate Isles within that whole world that it really unlocked it for me. And I think the characters inform the world when you're writing a fantasy series as much as the world informs the characters. They're kind of interdependent because a character is it's like the nature nurture debate, and the character is completely formed by their own experiences. So they kind of sh they do shape each other. It's a symbiotic relationship. However, I would say that with these books, because it's a young adult book and it's a coming of age story, it's very character driven. It's very driven by Mira's thoughts, her reactions, her decision making. So even though we've got the world as kind of the backdrop, the way that we navigate through it is very much based on Mira and her experiences and her viewpoint through the world. However, we are getting another point of view in book two. So it's going to be a dual POV book, and I'm very excited to introduce this new character who we haven't met before. And you're going to get a whole new perspective on the world through her eyes.
And so, did you think when you first started that you were going to do book two as a dual POV, or was this like just a whole new change for you?
I remember walking into my publisher's HarperCollins office in London for the first time, and it was just after the first book had been acquired. And I went there just for a meeting with my agent and met the whole team. And that was when I first told them, like, by the way, the second book, it's going to have another perspective in it, and it's going to be this person. And they were like, whoa, okay, we weren't expecting that, but great. So that was me kind of getting the green light for being able to have a dual POV. In the third book, I think I'll be adding another one as well. I'm a huge fan of like epic, sprawling, multi-POV fantasy series. So this is just me having fun.
So another thing, and you mentioned this earlier, but I really love when there's maps in books. And
Yes.
often you're not drawing the map, right? Like, could you talk a little bit about the map, like how this, because you have this in your head, and then I'm going to assume, and maybe I'm assuming incorrectly, that you had to talk with someone about your world and get them to draw your world for you,
Yeah,
correct?
that's right. And I'm actually really glad that you've asked this because the map, it started out as kind of for me like something that I'd just done for myself just so that I'd know what was around it, the Fortune Isles, and it was stick figures and terrible pencil line drawings. It wasn't worth printing. My publisher agreed that they would commission a map, which I was very excited about, and I said to them, would you consider this local artist? She's 19 years old. She's at university. She does the most incredible prints of the islands where I live. Sent them a link to her portfolio, and they agreed that she'd be perfect. She's called Daisy Davis. Local artist, lives on one of the islands where I live. And I know her family. I've known her since she was a little girl. And so when she got the commission, we met up in person and we talked over like our ideas for how the map was going to look, and all the place names. And from there, she created the first sketch, and then we gave some feedback, me and my editor, and she worked on it. And it was a very simple process from there of creating the final map. And I loved that got to work with Daisy because she created something that was very unique and something that I haven't seen in any other fantasy books, this style of map. But it's very much related to the story. There's lots of shells and things on it. There's like sea creatures in the sea surrounding the kind of continent. The writing is really beautiful and flowing of all the like place names. That was a joy to get to work with someone local, someone from the islands where I live on this map. And now it's all over the world. And so Daisy's got her first piece of artwork everywhere, and that's pretty wonderful.
That is, I'm so glad I asked because I love maps and I love that you said like the map is going to change as you kind of move through the trilogy and sort of learn more about it. So, oh, that's wonderful. I'm so glad that Daisy Davis gets her map.
It was pretty exciting all round that HarperCollins wanted to work with her as well.
Awesome. So we've been talking for a while, so I'm hoping maybe you could read a bit of this for us so we can sort of hear and get a feel for what the book is about.
Yeah, of course. I'll read the first page so that you get an idea of the atmosphere of the world. Chapter 1. The thunder sends me running. As lightning cleaves the sky, casting a flash across the sand, I see the ship, an outline, a struggling beast in the water. Its carcass is spilling cargo, wood splintered and swollen. I gasp, pulling in a breath as I stumble over the rocks. The wind whips the rain against my skin, a sharp spray of cold dashing over my cheekbones. Am I too late? I ask as I reach the group on the beach. A hand fumbles for mine, callous fingers gripping my own. You're cold, Mira, my father says, blue eyes hidden under the folds of his hood. Take my gloves when you go in. I nod, avoiding the fact that we both know I don't need them, that as soon as I hit the water, I will no longer feel the cold. Moving towards the line, I find my place along the length of slick rope. Six others are with me, six other islanders who have the song of the sea in their blood, who can endure in the ocean and not succumb to her ways so easily. But none of them can last as long as I can. None of them can find warmth beneath the waves.
So that really sets us up for what is going to happen, hopefully, like what the island is like, what she's sort of feeling. So, Can you tell us a little bit? So the book is out right now. So my, usually my final question is, and we've been talking a little bit about this trilogy, but what can we expect? Do you have anything going on with Compass and Blade right now, or know anything about your timeline? What's going on? What do you want to sort of promote with this?
So the next book in the Compass and Blade series will be out in 2025. It will be out, I believe, at the minute it's slated for March 2025. We don't have an exact date yet, but that will be US, Canada, UK, New Zealand, Australia, all of those places. I also have an adult standalone, which is out in October this year, in the US as well. And that's called the Woodsmoke Women's Book of Spells. And that is a speculative romance book. You could class it as a romantasy, but it's in a contemporary setting. And that is about a woman who returns home to her hometown after 10 years away. But Woodsmoke isn't an ordinary town. It's in the foothills of a vast mountain range. And it's threaded with curses and magic. So I'm definitely not straying from the sort of fantasy romantasy arena with my work.
But magic and curses are always a good thing.
Absolutely. Who doesn't want to read about magic and curses and romance?
Exactly. I really don't know who doesn't want to. I mean, that's really sad if you don't want to. I really think those are all really important things in life, right? So it's been wonderful again, Rachel Greenlaw, author of Compass and Blade. Thanks so much for talking with me for New Books in Literature.
Thank you so much, Rebecca. I've really enjoyed this. Yeah, thank you.